Oh, again, I believe we can make it. Oh, 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 oh.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. With a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
If they keep on polluting the earth and telling where we're gonna plant our seed, it makes me wanna cry for the children.
Solar power, ever see a windmill go? Feel the pull of an ocean wave, the heat from a volcano. There's so much we could do, there's so much we could know, if we listen to the earth.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. And coming up now is a special on unintelligent design. So stay tuned.
Ezekiel connected them. God bones, Ezekiel connected them. God bones, Ezekiel connected them. God bones, now hear the word of the Lord. But when your toe bone connected to it, foot bone, your foot bone connected to it, heel bone connected to it. Ankle bone connected to you. Leg bone connected to you. Knee bone connected to you. Thigh bone connected to you. Hip bone connected to you. Back bone connected to you. Shoulder bone connected to you. Your neck bone connected to you. Head bone, now hear the word of the Lord. Them bones gonna walk around them.
Dry Bones from the TV show Singing Detective. And I want to thank Reggie Johnson for coming up with the idea of having that as a song about human anatomy, because that's what we're going to be talking about today with Dr. Abigail A. Hafer. She is got her doctorate on zoology from Oxford and now teaches human anatomy and physiology at Curry College in New England. And I met her at Aresia, and she gave an absolutely wonderful talk there. And I just had to have her share her wonderful comments here on WBAI New York. And if you have anybody out of town or you want to hear this show, they can hear it on WBAI.org. So I'm not sure if just talking about bones is completely applicable, since we're talking about so much different kinds of human anatomy this morning. Do you want to start where you started at Aresia?
Okay. What I mostly get across in talking about unintelligent design is that our bodies, although they're wonderful, we have a lot of parts that really could have been made better if we really had been designed. If a designer had been given an engineering project with our specifications, things would have been done differently. And so what I do is talk about a bunch of our body parts that really could have been designed better. So my first and favorite lead-off example is men's testicles. And men's testicles are a great lead-off argument, because after that, everybody pays attention. And the problem, which most men can relate to, is that they hang outside the body, and that makes them very vulnerable. And some people know the reason for this, and some people don't, but basically, human normal body temperature is too hot for sperm production. And when you think about that, that's really bad design. Having normal body temperature be too hot for sperm production, man, an engineer really should have done better with that. So the testicles hang outside the body, and men are made vulnerable, and they risk severe pain and worse because of this unfortunate positioning. And, you know, if you're talking about intelligent design, well, I would think that God could do better.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, God did do better by frogs, who have their testicles inside them, as anybody who ever took high school biology can tell you. You do a frog dissection, you find the frog's testicles safely up in his abdomen, and birds also have their testicles on the inside. So it's not that having testicles on the inside is impossible, it's that human men didn't get that better design. And so you kind of have to ask, you know, who does this creator like better, frogs or human men? And this is the kind of question that the intelligent design folks really don't like.
No, I would guess not, especially when you have examples where they did. And, of course, women's anatomy is also not good design.
Right. Yeah, women also have problems with the way that we're put together. There's a fundamental engineering problem that we have. Women give birth, and as most women have experienced, giving childbirth is really painful and really difficult, and in the old days, it frequently killed the woman or the baby or both. I mean, it's a fairly deadly, dangerous process. And the reason is that we have such big heads. And the reason why we have such big heads is because we're so darn smart. We need big heads to fit our big brains into. We also walk upright, and that unfortunately favors people with narrow hips, because it's just much easier and more convenient and more efficient to have narrow hips if you're going to walk upright. Meanwhile, wide hips are favored by the fact that we have big heads. Because with big heads, you need a wide birth canal. With wide birth canals, you need wide hips. So we have this fundamental tension. And what we have is an uneasy compromise. It doesn't work very well. In the old days, it killed lots of women. Nowadays, we do lots of cesarean sections. We just avoid the birth canal altogether, which is kind of evidence, if you need it, that even we don't think we're terribly well designed. And kangaroos, on the other hand, got the better option. I say kangaroos got what we should have gotten if we really had been designed, because they give birth to very small embryo-like young that are then placed in a pouch on the outside of the mother's body. And that pouch has a nice comfy pouch. It's complete with a nipple for nursing. The embryos are very small when they're placed into this pouch, and that's just where they continue their development. So kangaroo females don't get torn apart by childbirth. And given our big heads, That would be the sensible way to design a human female if we really had been designed. Either that or the creator likes kangaroos a whole lot better than he or she or they like us.
He, she, they, right. That covers just about everybody listening. And now, South America was full of marsupials, you know, where the kangaroo family is, when it was an island. So does that mean that placenta mammals are better evolved because they outcompeted the marsupials when the Isthmus of Panama rose?
Okay. Well, first of all, of course, marsupials are still very common in Australia, mm-hmm. and Australia is simply full of kangaroos and lots of other interesting marsupials. As for South America and competition, well, this is an interesting thing. In fact, there are two interesting things here. One is that if you were designing animals for optimality, then you'd take the best features of marsupials and placental mammals. And for most placental mammals, having a pouch doesn't matter. For a dog or a cat, the way we've got it works very well. It's only when you start getting into these highly evolved big-headed humans who walk upright as well, so sort of two very different features that we have, that you'd think that going back to having a pouch would make a whole lot of sense. But we didn't get to choose some features from the marsupial plan and some features from the placental mammal plan. You know, we just got what we got and we have to live with it, which again does not indicate design. And the other thing that's interesting is that, of course, competition kind of goes against the whole idea of design. If you have a coyote who is perfectly designed to catch rabbits and it's chasing a rabbit, but the rabbit is also perfectly designed to avoid, well, I kind of wish that the creator would choose a side and stick with it. You know, you can't really say, I think very effectively, that all animals are well designed or perfectly designed, because then nothing would ever manage to eat anything.
I did a show on predators in the environment and their role, and I had an ornithologist from Cornell talking about hawks and other birds of prey, and he mentioned that predators actually help their prey evolve by taking out the weakest and the worst individuals. So the best survive, reproduce, and so the prey gets better and better. And so the predator also has to get better and better. And he said that if you really observe long enough at a bird feeder, you can actually watch this in action and watch the birds learn.
Yeah, predator-prey interactions are incredibly interesting. Now, when you get into learning, and then you're getting into something which isn't necessarily genetic, of course.
Uh-huh.
But certainly with predator-prey interactions over time, you can see all sorts of interesting things happening. And that's actually a good example of one reason why this argument about evolution and intelligent design is incredibly important, because you can't really understand ecology if you don't accept evolution. In fact, if you don't understand evolution pretty well, you can't make good policy decisions regarding the environment, because ecology is all about the interactions between plants and animals and their environments, and those have all evolved over time. And so if you take away one prey species or one predator species or a certain kind of nesting site or certain other things that are crucial to a given species or a bunch of species, you're going to completely change the environment, and it'll be utterly unpredictable if you believe in intelligent design. Whereas you can actually figure out what's going on to a far greater degree if you actually accept and understand evolution.
Well, as you were saying that, I was thinking about a deer crashing into somebody's home because it was hungry. You know, you wouldn't have deer doing that if their predators were still in their environment.
Right. In fact, a number of interesting studies have been done showing that when deer populations are allowed to explode because predators are taken away, they breed and breed and breed and then eventually starve. But in the process of starving, they also deplete the natural food sources that they have, so that even after there's a mass die-off of the prey species, the land is no longer able to support as large a population of that species as it used to. This is called carrying capacity, the business of how many individuals of a given kind the environment can support. And carrying capacity actually goes down when predators are removed. It goes down over time, as I said, after there's a population boom, followed by a stripping of the environment, followed by mass starvation and a crash. As I said, when that population recovers, it recovers at a lower carrying capacity than existed before. This has been studied, this has been documented in many places over many years.
And we're speaking with Dr. Abigail Hafer, a teacher of human anatomy and physiology at Curry College. What town in New England is that in?
It's in Milton, Massachusetts.
Which is what part of Massachusetts?
Okay, that is almost due south of Boston.
Ah, okay. And Massachusetts isn't that large. I think anybody can find that on a map just with that description.
Oh, yeah. Massachusetts, especially north-south, is not that big. If you just look south of Boston, before you get to either the ocean or Rhode Island, you'll find Milton.
Now, one of the things that the creationists, who now call themselves intelligent designers or whatever their word is, they love to use the human eye as an example of intelligent design. And you like to use the human eye as an example also.
I do indeed. Yeah, I like using the eye in two different ways. The intelligent design folks like to use the human eye because they say it is irreducibly complex. This is one of their big arguments, irreducible complexity, that basically it couldn't have evolved from simpler forms. And one of the things you see if you study zoology is that there are a whole lot of simple eyes out there. You can have other animals with eyes that are as complicated as ours, right down to eyes that are just little pits with a few photoreceptor cells in them. And you can go even lower than that with a single-celled animal like, organism like a euglena that just has a little spot of a light-sensitive pigment that nonetheless allows this organism to orient itself towards the sun in order to aid photosynthesis. So even this tiny little eye spot, as it's called, which is just a little patch of photopigment, helps do the job that eyes do. That is to say, what eyes do is they respond to light, and that information is useful to the organism. And by the way, the whole business of photopigments is not terribly magic either. It's called a colors bleach in the sun. And if you have ever had clothes that you dried on a clothesline or left outside or just used a lot outdoors, you know that colors bleach in the sun.
Now, I remember when I first heard the argument about the eye, and they said that there are no intermediate eyes in the fossil record. And then about 2 weeks afterwards, somebody published what they discovered earlier, which was a nice intermediate eye. And yet, you were mentioning that there's a lot of intermediate eyes right now, alive today. You don't even have to look in the fossil record.
Right. You don't have to look in the fossil record at all. There are intermediate eyes all around us. And there have been papers published on that. You can look at bivalves, that's clams and their relatives, snails, gastropods, and they have lots and lots of intermediate eyes. As I said, from ones that are kind of, they have lenses, but and then some photoreceptors, and then you have eyes that don't have lenses, but have these fairly deep pits so that you can get some concept of the direction the light's coming in, and then you can have shallow pits, which only give a little bit of directionality, and as I said, all the way down to a simple eye spot, which is just a little bit of pigment. So you can have eyes that are reduced. You can see them working, and that's the main part that I'm getting together. This isn't something that we've come up with that we think might work, that, you know, if we draw it, you can see how it could possibly happen. No, these eyes are out there right now doing the job that eyes do, and the organisms benefit from them. So you don't even have to look in the fossil record to see simple eyes. the other thing about the eye is that it's actually our eye, the human eye, is that it's actually badly designed in one very important way. And this is a little bit hard to explain without pictures, but basically, if you imagine light coming into our eye from the pupil, it goes through the clear pupil, it goes through the clear lens, it goes through the clear vitreous humor, which is in the back of our eyeball, and then it hits a whole lot of stuff. It hits nerve fibers. It hits various support cells for the visual system and so on. It hits a whole lot of opaque stuff, and so the light gets partially blocked before it actually gets to the photoreceptor cells. Those are the cells that respond to light. So this would be, if you had a camera, like if you had all of the mechanical parts of the camera between the lens and the film, if you use a film camera, or the visual chip, if you're using a digital camera. And so you have all of this blocked light, and that actually does mean that we get rather poor quality visual information, which then has to go through the equivalent of photoshopping, before we get something that is sort of like the outside world, sort of like what we're actually looking at, but information has been lost. And so it's this very cumbersome, imperfect process, and it even means that there is one part of our eye where all of these nerve fibers and blood vessels and other things converge and then dive straight through the retina to get into the optic nerve. There's this one part of the eye that is so clogged with all this other stuff that it can't see at all. And this is called our blind spot. And you can actually find your own blind spot. I don't know if it's up on the website, but I sent along a little blind spot handout that people can print out, and they can test it themselves, and this is a whole lot of fun. You can find your own blind spot. And putting preventable blind spots into a visual system is not the sign of an intelligent creator. And it would have been very easy to put all of these support structures behind the photoreceptors. And that wasn't done in humans, but that's the way that squid have their eyes built. Squid eyes and their whole family, called the cephalopods, have eyes that are very much like ours, except that all of that support paraphernalia is behind the photoreceptors. So they actually got better eyes than we did. So you have to ask, who does this creator like better, us or a squid? And, you know, the creator really seems to have problems with coming up with designs, with using a good idea over and over once something has been come up with. So, you know, this creator has a lot of explaining to do.
So our own nerve endings that translate what our eyes see to the brain, so we know what we're seeing, block what we're seeing.
Correct.
It's so amazing that I'm surprised that people want to use the eye as an example of intelligent design.
Well, they love the way that it is. And I've got to say, I mean, our eyes really are cool and wonderful. And in fact, one of the things that I want to emphasize is the human body really is wonderful. But it's wonderful in the weird and crazy way that evolved systems are wonderful, not wonderful in the sort of careful mathematical way that designed systems are. So you see a lot of beauty, but not design. And unfortunately, you know, the intelligent design folks, first of all, don't pay a whole lot of attention to facts like ecology or how the eye is actually put together or how our bodies are actually put together. And they also just dislike the fact that, you know, somebody they know isn't in charge of all this. But the eye, as I said, although it is wonderful in some ways, everybody who wears glasses knows that the eye is far from perfect. And right down at the very base of our ability to see, with the blind spot and with all of this processing equipment in front of the photoreceptors, you'd think that the intelligent design people wouldn't like that example, but they use it anyway, which is one of the interesting things about the intelligent design movement, which is that facts don't stop it. you can correct them on something dozens of times, and they'll repeat the same old junk that they talked about before. They're really not interested in refutation. That's not where their heads are at. Their heads are into politics. They simply want to have their religion taught in American public schools at taxpayer expense, and they see having intelligent design taught in science classrooms as their way into the American public school system. So they're not interested in science. They're interested in politics. They talk to state legislators. They have lawsuits. They try to control textbooks. They do things that are political rather than things that are scientific. That's what they're about.
And I really liked your point, which bears repeating, that in order to make intelligent public policy on the political level, you really need to know about what you're making the policy about.
Yes.
But politicians, of course, all they need to know about is what the surveys say about which side is involved in this or that issue.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's not really the way that science works. And I think that that's one of the reasons why intelligent design has gotten as far as it has. Scientists would really, truly believe that the facts will win out. And so we do research and we write papers and we publish them in scientific journals that are read by other scientists, and most people don't hear about it. And most people don't realize that we have libraries. I mean, the whole libraries full of evidence for evolution. And so it's partly that a lot of people don't understand and that scientists themselves have not done terribly good outreach. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I do what I do. But getting back to the policy business, I think of, if anything, even greater immediate importance is public health policy. Because right now we have antibiotic-resistant bacteria that have evolved in response to our antibiotics. We have drug-resistant parasites that have evolved in response to our antiparasitic drugs. And they are now killing people that we used to be able to cure. We now have drug-resistant tuberculosis. We have the MRSA bacteria, that's methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, which kills people at any age, and we're helpless to fight it. And this is all because we have not done a good job thus far with making public health decisions that are based on evolution. And this is killing people right now.
Yeah, I remember reading that the best way to explain evolution is just to talk about our human body evolving to fight microbes, and the microbes evolve to fight what we've done to fight them, and it just goes on and on and on.
And it goes on and on and on, right.
And I think somebody said there's thousands and thousands of different species of microbes in our body, most of them beneficial, some of them not, and some of them are not only when they're not in the wrong ratio, but compared to the other microorganisms, that our human body is like an ecosystem.
Yeah, and that's actually a very good thing to point out. You can, when you start thinking of it, it's kind of like your bird feeder as well. You can see a lot of these interactions, or you can certainly feel the results of these interactions. When you take a course of antibiotics, some obviously the bacteria throughout your body are wiped out, not just the ones you're trying to kill. And at that point, for instance, the yeast that also exists naturally in your intestinal tract will breed up because it no longer has competition. And that's why yeast infections are more common after a course of antibiotics, because there are more yeast, which then, just because they have a greater population, there are more of them around to potentially infect the other parts of the body.
So it's an ecosystem out of balance, but in this case, the ecosystem is us.
Yeah, right, right. No, we have lots of organisms that live happily inside us. This is called symbiosis. And again, this is something that makes a whole lot of sense from an evolutionary standpoint.
I was at a microbial conference a couple of years ago, and they said that when money is made available to study microbes, it's only pathogens, that we tend not to study the microbes that help us survive, only the ones that get in the way.
Well, that's a really interesting point. And it's unfortunately true. Any science will get more money if it affects human health. And so you get a lot more money for studying diseases than you're going to get for studying other microbes. you're going to get more money for studying the human body than for studying animals. And that's unfortunately just kind of, you know, the way our funding system works. There are other microbes that we have come to love because they ferment things for us. And so, you know, beer makers are pretty pretty fond of the microbes that they use. And these days, actually, there is a whole industry of fermentation where we figured out that microbes can help us make chemicals. And so those microbes are becoming more fully studied. And, of course, with recombinant DNA technology, people are beginning to like microbes because they can help humans with things like cleaning up oil slicks. That's the more, one of the more famous examples. But, you know, we tend to look out for our own utility first, both for good and for ill.
We're speaking with Dr. Abigail A. Hafer, who teaches human anatomy and physiology at Curry College in Medford, Massachusetts.
Milton, Massachusetts.
I'll get that right eventually. Milton, Massachusetts, just south of Boston. And she got her degree in zoology at Oxford. And I won't ask you when, because that's not right. Now, what about all of the vestigial organs that we have?
Okay, that's a good example. I did also just want to get in that I have written a book about a lot of these bad body parts. But getting back to vestigial organs, yeah, I mean, another of my favorite bad body parts is our appendix. And the appendix basically has no use in the human body. And so that's the first pointer that it's bad design. That, you know, here is something that actually has no utility at all for us. It does, it has some lymph nodes in it and a few things like that, but so does the rest of the digestive tract. So that's not anything terribly special about the appendix. It has no particular function, and that's certainly not a sign of good design. But then on top of that, every now and then, it gets a really lethal infection called appendicitis. And if the appendix bursts, then you die. And in the days before decent surgical techniques, people regularly died from infected appendixes. These days, we have invented good surgical techniques due, again, to science. And we know that if someone has appendicitis, that you have to remove the appendix quickly, preferably before it bursts, or you're going to be in a lot of trouble. And it's a vestigial organ, which means that some ancestor of ours had an appendix that was useful. And if you look at other animals, if they digest woody plants, the bacterial colonies that naturally grow in these two blind sacs in our digestive system, they're called the appendix and the cecum. And the appendix is actually a blind sac off of another blind sac called the cecum. Anyway, in other animals, there are bacterial colonies in the cecum and appendix, and they help the animals to digest woody parts of plants. So rabbits actually have big cecums and appendixes, getting back to marsupials, koala bears do. Lots and lots of animals that digest woody plants have these huge cecums and appendixes with big, healthy bacterial colonies in them. And that's where the wood gets digested by all the bacteria in these pouches. Now, we don't digest wood, so again, you kind of have to ask why the Creator gave us an organ that works best in rabbits. And since we don't digest wood, we have this very small reduced vestigial appendix, which doesn't kill us before childbirth too much of the time, and so we still have it. That's the basic, very low bar for evolution, is that a feature doesn't kill us before we reproduce too much of the time. It's not a very high bar, but it's the one that works for evolution, because all you need to do in evolution is reproduce. It's, you know, it's not pretty, but that's the way it works. And we do have some other vestigial organs that people may understand.
I remember a comment you made about somebody saying that the purpose of the appendix is for the financial support of the surgical profession.
Well, yes, that's another idea as well. And that's something that you will find in one particular old anatomy and physiology textbook because the appendix just has no use, and we so frequently dislike the idea of something having no use, although Gray's Anatomy, that famous old tome, calls it a functionless organ. But as I said, just as, you know, something to say about the appendix, this one textbook does say, well, maybe it exists in order to financially support the surgical profession. And so, you know, it may be that the creator likes surgeons best. and, you know, that's
another
thought.
And I was thinking, when you're talking about, you know, it's to digest woody plants, and I thought right away that the Neanderthals had tougher teeth and stronger jaws and the brow ridges that support the jaw muscles because they ate tougher plants.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that fits right in with they must have really needed that appendix if they were eating these tough plants.
Well, I don't think we have soft parts from Neanderthals, so that would be harder to say.
Mm.
And obviously the invention of cooking changed a whole lot as well. So, you know, exactly, we get our nutrition these days in a very different way, and I don't even mean in our modern post-industrial world. But once we kind of figured out fire and cooking, it opened up the door to a very different way of eating.
And you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM, and this is a special on unintelligent design with Dr. Abigail Hafer. And I'm Ken Gale. I normally do Ecologic. This is a special for this subject. So, Dr. Hafer, what are some of the other vestigial aspects of our body that design does not explain, but evolution does?
Okay, well, I mean, one obvious example is if you look at a human skeleton, if you look at the whole set of bones in the spinal column, you go down to the very end, to our hip area, and you will see two bones called the sacrum and the coccyx. And if you look at them, you can see what it is a tail. And, you know, all vertebrates have tails, and we've got one, too. At this point, the tail is not expressed outside the body the way a dog or a cat's tail is, but nonetheless, the bones are still there. We still have the bones for a tail, and as I said, if you look at a human skeleton, you can see the tail plain as day. As I said, we call them the sacrum and the coccyx, but it's a tail. it's a vestigial tail, and it's a nice example of an organ that we don't use, but our ancestors did and our relatives do. Prenatal gill slits is another very interesting example. Many different species go through the same stages of embryonic development, including the gill slit stage. And so we have gill slits at a certain stage in our development. And we don't use gills, but some animal in our ancestry did. And another really cool example that I like a great deal.
Well, what month is the gill slits? Are they there?
Couldn't tell you straight off the bat. It's after a few weeks. But another example that I love is actually goosebumps. Think about it. We've got hair all over our body. It's just sort of very fine and small hair. And there are two times when we get goosebumps. We get goosebumps when we're cold, and we get goosebumps when we're frightened. It doesn't do us any good at all. It's a vestigial response. But think about an animal that has a fur coat. Think about your dog if you own a dog or a cat. If you get frightened and your hair stands on end, you look bigger. And if you're trying to face down an enemy or a competitor or whatever, if you have to fight and you look bigger, then you're much more likely to be able to get your enemy to back down. And so looking bigger is something that animals try to do all the time. And so if you're frightened and suddenly your hair stands on end, you look like a bigger animal, and it also obscures your throat area, so that it's going to be harder to kill you. So that's why we get goosebumps when we're frightened. It doesn't do us any good, but it does our animal relatives good, and it obviously did our ancestors good. Likewise, when we're cold. Think of birds on a cold day. They fluff up their feathers. They're getting a thicker coat of insulation. That's what we're trying to do when we get goosebumps when we're cold. We no longer have enough hair to make any practical difference, but we've still got that leftover response. That's a vestigial response. Does that make sense?
It certainly does, and I find it interesting. I do remember in hiking out west where there are cougars, and there's all these, you know, warning pamphlets about what to do if there's a cougar nearby to keep safe, and they said, you know, don't act like it's a bear and play dead, and then they say enlarge your image to make yourself look bigger and make the cougar back down. Like if you have a coat, unzipper it and hold it out.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife tried it on a friend's cat when the cat wouldn't go back indoors, and she enlarged her image and the cat ran away.
Yeah, as I said, there's a lot of faking things out in nature because contrary to kind of, you know, the popular blood and guts image as seen on a lot of TV shows, a lot of animals spend a lot of time trying to avoid fights. Every now and then you'll have some kind of aggressive interaction, and it makes for good TV.
Mm-hmm.
But a whole lot of the time, animals would really prefer to avoid fights because, of course, if you get a fight, not only might you lose and die, even if you win, you might get injured. And injury is a serious problem in the animal world. I mean, you know, they don't have good doctors and antibiotics like we do. And so, as I said, if there are ways to avoid fighting, then animals will try it. Absolutely.
I've even seen this with humans in street fights, where you know, the street fight may last 25 minutes, but the violent part of it is about 30 seconds. Everything else is posturing.
Right.
And trying to get people who are watching to join on their side and things like that. And I mean, it's kind of bizarrely interesting to watch a street fight and realize there's nothing actually happening.
Right. And very often, if there were some way of one side backing down and escaping safely, they might do it. As I said, this is, you know, not always. I mean, sometimes you're just going to have an aggressive interaction. But in many cases, if there's a way of getting out of it, animals certainly will try that.
Well, I think part of diplomacy is to get the other country to save face, but at the same time do what you want them to do.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I guess, you know, we haven't changed that much from all the animals we were just referring to. And our own teeth. You mentioned you went into teeth.
Yeah, well, teeth are another example where, you know, if we had been designed starting, you know, with a pad of paper and somebody doing sketches, then we would have come out differently. We only get two sets of teeth in our entire lives. We get our baby teeth, which fall out pretty early. And then we get our adult teeth. And basically, our teeth rot. Our teeth get infections. Our teeth, left to their own devices, shorten our lives. You know, we need them to chew, but on the other hand, they're avenues for infections in a lot of way, for the obvious reason that they come into contact with food all the time. Food gets mm-hmm. stuck around the teeth, even just microscopic bits. And bacteria then have co-evolved, as you said, to take advantage of this ready food source. And they then make films around our teeth. This is what plaque is. And they secrete acids, and the acids erode our teeth. And this is all a very natural process. And in the natural world, people frequently died from abscesses. And until very recently, they generally lost all of their teeth at a pretty early age if they didn't die from one of the abscesses along the way. And we had to invent dentists in order to combat this problem. And when you think about it, this shows just how awful our design is, that people were willing to put up with the horrible pain of dentistry prior to anesthesia in order to control the infections, because otherwise you would die. And we have the potential to live for many decades, but that potential was frequently not realized because of our lousy teeth, as well as many, many other bacterial infections. And then you have sharks. And sharks can live for many decades. Sharks in the natural environment can live up to 100 years or more, and they never, ever go to the dentist. They didn't have to invent dentistry because they just keep making new teeth. also the teeth don't have the opportunity to rot and get infections, which then allow the bacteria to enter the rest of the body, which then makes an organism sick. So, you know, they just keep sloughing off their teeth. And, you know, a great white shark goes through something like 30,000 teeth in a year. I mean, it's just prodigious output.
30,000 in 1 year.
Yeah, in 1 year. It's
and we
amazing.
Have, we have 32 for our lives.
For our entire lives. And if we don't go to the dentist and do all sorts of other tooth care, they don't last our entire lives,
right,
or they kill us. So, you know, sharks got the better deal. And, again, you can ask yourself, you know, what does this say about the creator's personality?
And, well, one topic that you went into detail about at Aresia, which I should add is a science fiction convention in Boston on Martin Luther King Day weekend that I usually do a few panels every year. And that is where I met Dr. Abigail Hafer, who teaches human anatomy and physiology at Curry College in Milton, Massachusetts.
And I should add, they don't just do science fiction at Aresia. I was actually talking about real science, and
yeah,
they talk about that there, too.
They have about six panels going on at the same time, and one of them, at least one of them, I should say, is always a science track. It's, you know, Boston, so you have, you know, MIT and Harvard, and you have all these places to draw scientists from, and they speak at these conventions. Time Weissmuller, who's been on Ecologic several times, speaks there every year about climate science and meteorology and things. So, of course, people interested in science fiction tend to be interested in science as well, so here's the basis. And you have, you know, future authors there going to panels of a science fiction writer and a scientist putting it together and coming up with some interesting story. And I'm sure you'll be some sort of character in somebody's story at some point. Now, the air and food passages.
Yes, our air and food passages meet and mix. We breathe through our mouths and our noses, and then the air gets funneled into our trachea, our windpipe. And, of course, we take in food through our mouth, and then the food and the water that we take in gets funneled down into our esophagus, which leads to our stomachs. And this usually works, but not always. And sometimes you can inhale your food literally, and it winds up in your windpipe. And most people have this experience when they're young. They, you know, inhale cracker crumbs, and they have to cough for a while or so on. But more seriously, you can inhale large pieces of food this way. Children, this is one of the reasons why very young children, parents are told not to give them hard candy, because if they inhale quickly, then the hard candy can be inhaled and block a child's tiny trachea.
Well, that's why the Lifesaver candy was invented.
Correct.
Because
yes,
somebody's daughter, or I think it was daughter, died from eating hard candy. And so he said, well, if there was a hole in it, she could have breathed. And that was invented on Grove Street in the Greenwich Village in New York City, by the way.
There you go. I didn't know where they were invented, but that is the reason for the hole in the Lifesaver. It's why they're called Lifesavers. But when in adults, it's more likely to be, say, a piece of steak or something like that. If people are having a good conversation over dinner, they will inhale, and they'll inhale that food right into their windpipe, and it will block breathing. And this can kill you, and it can kill you very, very quickly. This is why the Heimlich maneuver was invented. And that's been invented in my lifetime. Prior to that time, it was actually very hard to save people who had tracheas that were blocked by food. And even today, you still have a fair number of people who die from inhaling food and then having their trachea blocked. So, you know, again, a good designer would have made these tubes separate. It's just too dangerous. And whales did get separate tubes. If you look at a whale, you'll see its blowhole, or a dolphin, I should say, or a porpoise. Look at the blowhole on the top of its head. That blowhole is actually its nostrils. And whales and dolphins' respiratory systems are completely separate from their digestive systems. So they can't die from inhaling their food the way we can. And again, you have to ask, who does this creator like better, whales or us?
And, of course, they're mammals, too.
And they are mammals, yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. So they just, you know, they wound up with a different system. And, again, if we had been designed starting with a piece of paper and just trying to come up with the best design ideas possible, we should have gotten separate tubes for air versus food and water.
And one of the questions you got at Aresia was somebody asking you what you thought this debate would be like 500 years from now. And I liked your answer.
And what did I say?
I was wondering. You said it depends on the politics. It's like asking a geologist to teach the flat earth controversy.
Yeah, well, I'll start with the geology part. That, yeah, I mean, the whole business of what intelligent design people will call teaching the controversy, that is to say, they invent doubt where none exists, and then say, well, since there is doubt, it must be taught as a controversy in American public school science classrooms. So they invent this doubt, and it's rather like asking a geologist to teach the flat earth controversy. There is no controversy. It's a made-up controversy that doesn't exist outside of the intelligent designer's mind, and the answer is not compromise. Again, this would be like saying that, oh, well, a compromise between the flat earth position and the spherical earth position would be an earth O-shaped like a sofa cushion. Well, that's just not right. There is no controversy. One answer is right, one answer is wrong. There is such a thing as a fact. But how this all pans out in the future really does depend upon politics. If you like fact-based thinking, which has enabled us, for instance, since the invention of modern science, we've figured out gravity. We can now launch satellites, which you could never do by relying on the Bible. If we want to go with a fact-based way of thinking, then intelligent design is very, very dangerous. And so, you know, the future really does depend upon us. And in 500 years, if we have a theocracy, then the intelligent design people will have won, and something like intelligent design will be taught. Though I personally think that in 500 years, if they have heard of intelligent design at all, they will be thinking, what were these people thinking? In some of the ways as we now look upon some of the things that our ancient ancestors thought, and we just think, oh, those poor people, they just didn't know. You know, that's probably the way it will go, but we don't actually know that.
Well, let's close with a little bit about St. Augustine.
Okay.
Who was telling Christians that if you're going to talk about something that's not religion, you'd better be right, or people won't believe you when you talk about religion.
Yeah. What St. Augustine said, in effect, is that if you're talking about stuff outside of religion, stuff where there are actual facts involved, that if you get your facts wrong, you'll not only make yourself sound foolish, you'll make religion, whatever religion you're practicing, sound foolish. And I think that that's a very good point. And I personally want to put in a plug for the idea that actually evolution is the greatest indisputably true story ever told.
Thank you, Dr. Abigail Hafer. She teaches human anatomy and physiology at Curry College in Milton, Massachusetts. She got her doctorate in zoology from Oxford, and she's been our guest here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org. This show will be archived. If you liked what you heard or you missed the beginning. Okay, well, thank you very much. And we'll go out with Talking Heads Animals, because, as they say in the song, they're setting a bad example. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.